Good afternoon and welcome. Thank you all for being here. I'm Connie Butler, Chief Curator of Drawings here at MoMA, and this is my colleague Katrine DeZager, the former director of the Drawing Center here in New York and currently co-organizer of the Sydney Biennale and my collaborator on the organizing of online Drawing Through the 20th Century, the exhibition that I hope many of you saw upstairs before coming today. I want to thank a few people for helping us organize today's event. First, Wendy Woon, Pablo Helguera, and Laura Bylis of the Education Department, who worked with us on conceptualizing the event and were supportive of organizing today's discussion from the very beginning. I also want to thank with Catherine Sheetal Prajapati, who coordinated everything and made today happen. I need, too, to acknowledge Esther Adler, who is a curatorial assistant in the Drawings Department and who worked with us closely on the exhibition and who would be here today, except she's spreading sand in the atrium of the museum in preparation for Aunt Teresa de Kersemacher's performance, which I all invite you to come see this weekend, tomorrow at 2 o'clock and at 5 o'clock, or maybe it's, yes, 2 o'clock.
4 o'clock.
Yeah. You should check the time. Tomorrow and Sunday. She'll be performing in the atrium as part of this performance and dance series that we've organized in conjunction with the exhibition. And finally, just to thank Glenn Lowry and Kathy Halbreich and all my curatorial colleagues here who've supported the exhibitions and its programs, and our wonderful colleagues who are here today. We have a great group, I think, of speakers, people close to the show, coming from far away, just looking at the show for the first time. So I'm going to, I think, just turn it right over to Katrine. You'll notice that in your programs you have everybody's bio, so we're not going to spend a long time today on that kind of information, but hopefully just get in right into discussion. Katrine.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm very grateful to MoMA and to its director and to the staff for having organized the exhibition, for having taken that risk. And, of course, especially to Glenn Lowry and to Connie Butler. And also for this event, I'm very happy that all participants could come to the panel. And because we have a very limited time, we have a long list of speakers, but we all will speak only like for 5 to 10 minutes and then have discussions. So I won't take too much of this time, and I will just introduce the first panel with the participants Luis Kamnitzer, Jean Fisher, Anna Maria Maiolino, and Julie Mereto. And as an introduction to the panel, I would like to say the following, that during the 20th century, many artists made line the subject of intense exploration, and that's what we try to show in this exhibition. And by line as such, they understood its existence in the world and the meaning that could be attributed to this existence as creative intention and interpretation. In fact, almost shaped as an eye, line is the first linguistic mark of differentiation, signifying the subject's entry into language. And much as poets and linguists were analyzing the line of speech or writing within the larger, organized verbal whole, and were asserting the importance of laying bare its elements and devices before anything could be said of its meaning, artists were investigating the traced line, drawn or painted. And unraveling its characteristics, they would go very far in interpreting its form and function. And behind this parallel analysis, which is so well featured in two parallel lines, the work made by Luis Kamnitzer that introduces the exhibition on the sixth floor, behind this parallel analysis was the belief of linguists and artists alike in the power of art to renew perception and to affect society. For the creation of a work of art was seen as the creation of the world. So when Kandinsky wrote his essay Online, published in Moscow in 1919, he and his contemporaries believed in the power of line to draw and transform society. They could hardly have imagined how line would indeed bring this change about, constructing the new reality of an online society at the end of the century. beginning with the modern artist's idea of line as a point in movement. The exhibition chronicles the key shifts by juxtaposing avant-garde, neo-avant-garde, postmodern, and contemporary drawings from diverse interrelated cultures. And as such, and in the light of current practices, it charts the evolution of drawing from 1910 to 2010 as a radical transformation of the medium, tracking its traverse from line as a moving of points through the grid structure to point as a crossing of lines, much as an online connection on the internet and the web. Indeed, by the end of the 20th century, the terms online and offline had come to refer to a state of connectivity or disconnectivity with respect to computer technology and telecommunication. And Jean Fisher will take up a specific fact in Native American history as a way of analyzing this transformation and its shift into virtual space. More or less. Jean, I will leave it enigmatic and to you. So that there is a relationship between the body moving over the land, the mountains, the plains, and then I'm leaving it to Jean to take it further. Crucially, this exhibition project has been conceived with artists' marks and lines, their conversations and writings at its core. And I really want to insist on this because it's everything, I mean, that I at least have learned is coming from the work of artists and from the conversations I've had with them. Juxtaposing over 300 works online examines different stages of the aesthetic exploration of line, the line in the plane, the line broken free from that imaginary surface, illusory surface, into real space, as, for example, in the experimental work of Anna Maria Maiolino, and finally, the apparent return to the relational space of the real and the imaginary, but with each now transformed in the process, as in the work of Julie Miretu with its confluence of layers and lines. In following the dilation of line's meaning, we also trace it in movement across disciplines and in its connectivity and continuity as it is drawn out and rewoven in time and space. Similarly, the history that informs the exhibition is interpreted here as an interweaving of materials, records, and the requirements of a changing present. This reading inevitably reflects notions of interconnection and interdependency in a new globalized society. Where thought had been linear and progressive, it has evolved into a kind of network, something more fluid and open and simultaneous. So now, most importantly, we will hear from our panelists, and I took the liberty of changing the order a little bit. So we will first hear Luis Kamnitzer, then Jean Fisher, then Anna Maria Maiolino, and then Julie Moretto. Thank you.
I will skip the expressions of gratitude to save time and jump in. I grew up bilingual in German and Spanish, and later had to fight my way through English. This would seem totally irrelevant information here. However, I was keenly aware that the best way to describe the different quality of the languages is referring to them as lines. German, of course, is a way of searching infinity with one single word. More interesting, however, is the relation that exists between English and Spanish. A translation from English to Spanish increases verbiage by about 50%. One could praise English for its succinctness and accuse Spanish of wastefulness. I, however, always felt that Spanish operates between the lines, while English narrowly functions on the line. Sometimes it does it to the point of sacrificing atmosphere in order to maintain its balance on a very thin tightrope. Yet English manages to be quite precise and functional. Instead of a tightrope, Spanish uses the lines as handrails to have one walk the space in between. There's nothing completely tangible here. Badly used, Spanish vagueness produces empty flourishes that lead nowhere, except for maybe tedious verborrhea and rhetorical self-satisfaction. But when well used, it sets the reader up for personal searches and discoveries while breathing the air of the author. Instead of being locked into words, one grasps the railings and navigates through them. That is a function of the extra 50%. I probably am all wrong with my analysis, but at least it gives me a good metaphor for drawing. A drawn line, after all, is nothing more than unfolded handwriting or vice versa. The problem becomes not so much the line itself, but the question of where precisely the content writes, it being text, subtext, context, or metatext. I'm tempted to also say post-text, but wouldn't yet know how to justify it. It is quite sad that we're restricted to the use of one word for all of the versions of drawing. It's quite un-English, actually. Jimmy Durham once broke this confining spell during a panel discussion about drawing. It was a very similar panel to this one, even sharing people. Jimmy started his presentation by reminiscing that while growing up, his family had a horse, and the horse drew a cart. He should have stopped his speech right there. I would say that here, being in a room where neither horses nor carts are allowed for sanitary reasons, drawing should, by default, be considered a way of processing information. This seems to be something quite clear and simple, until we try to pass off a telephone doodle for a Leonardo drawing. The thing is that at this point, it starts becoming important, not only that we are processing information, but also whom we are addressing with that information and why, and also what relevance all this may have for the audience. In other words, in drawing, there are monologues, orders, dialogues, and collectibles. These, of course, are never leak-free compartments. Monologues include doodles, shopping lists, and other notes that help our memory. It doesn't matter if anybody else understands our scribble as long we do. Orders are the opposite. They take the form of technical drawings. The requirement is absolute clarity, a lack of ambiguity, the absence of any uncertain terms, and it precludes the possibility of feedback. Dialogues, on the other hand, take into consideration the reaction and contribution of the viewer. It is here where the line, like good writing in Spanish, stops being the physical bearer and becomes a handrail. Well, and finally, collectibles are just that. One might add that there are two kinds of collectibles, the ones done as a dialogue and worth collecting, and those that are cynically made with the sole purpose of being collected. To use a general concept of drawing as information processing rather than as a skill or a craft is something quite important for me. That traditional skill view diminishes the whole thing to little more than leaving traces and trying to be good at it. Automatically, expectations are then raised about what may be a good trace and what doesn't cut it. Standards are set by the desirability to be collected and not by communication. This focus on good traces presumes that the very ultimate destiny of a drawing should be a museum. If you are not up to these standards, you better go to a vocational school, which is another funny term. What would be more vocational than trying to be an artist? Vocational school is, very precisely, the place where you cannot exercise your vocation because you are not good enough at what would you like to do. The skill view introduces comparison and intimidation. Processing information, however, is open to everybody. It works the same as literacy is supposed to work. We don't reserve literacy to those who we hope will be born again Shakespeare's, which leads me to suggest outlawing the statement, I'm not good at art. I can't draw a straight line. In AnswersYahoo.com, somebody named Paula made this exact statement and asked for help. Paula then added, I can be creative because I do write and I can crochet. And later, the best thing I ever drew was a raccoon. Apparently, there were many answers, but Sandra number 15 was the most voted one and the one shown on the webpage. Sandra tried to offer the desired help and be reassuring at the same time. She wrote, I can't draw a straight line, but I've gotten the art award at my high school for 2 years in a row, and the thing I'm best at is drawing realistic things. Then she recommended, you just have to learn how to draw what's in front of you before you can draw what's in your head. In a narrow and limited way, Sandra actually was referring to the processing of information. But by keeping the model's information away from her head, she also avoided any meaningful communication. And added to that, she was unable to put the things that actually were in her head in front of her. George D.D. Huberman laid out some of the conditions that were missing in the Yahoo exchange. In his image, in spite of all, he refers to processing information about those things we cannot see. His topic is the communications conundrums presented by the documentation about the Bergen-Belsen gas chambers. He's speaking about montage in filmmaking and not about drawing, but this doesn't matter much. He writes, what we cannot see must therefore be made into a montage so as to encourage, as far as possible, thinking about the differences between certain visual, separate, lacunary monads in such a way as to know, in spite of all, even that which remains impossible to see entirely, that which even remains inaccessible as in all. It is possible that the phrase between the monads is a more precise term for us than between the lines, which is the title of my thing. It tells us that we're dealing with ungraspable units that define an equally ungraspable space. That space is the one that includes text, subtext, context, or metatext, all of which coalesce in the viewer's imagination in an effort to break down inaccessibility. Maybe that actually would be the post-text. The concreteness of the line handrail image, I realize now, is a remnant from that world of skills I'm trying to escape. It is the same world that Paula is trying to enter, not knowing that the whole problem is not to restate what is visible, but to help imagine and grasp what is invisible. Sandra, number 15, on the other hand, does not realize that for the moment she is only advocating a form of trivial and empty calligraphy, alien to any pursuit of knowledge. Yes, it is about processing, but leaving the information out of it. It is a form of calligraphy useless to either English or Spanish speakers. Hard to believe, it is drawing as it mostly is still taught today. Boy, what a waste. Thank you.
I'm afraid, Kathy, my presentation veered off rather eccentrically from where you told me to start. In the first instance, because of where you told me to start, I was curious to think about drawing as a performance of self-world relations. And the figure that emerged from these ruminations was the map. And that developed into the counter map as a kind of detournement from conventional usage. But I will give you where I was supposed to start, okay, and it's a historical anecdote. In 1877, in the Northwest,
A band of Nez Perce, led by Chief Joseph, refused to be relocated to the reservation assigned to them by the US government. Making a break for freedom, they took off on foot for sanctuary in Canada, some 600 miles as the crow flies. Excuse me. Miffed by this display of independence, the government sent the cavalry in pursuit. The band, comprising women, children, the elderly, and some able-bodied men, actually veered south before moving north, zigzagging through the Bitterroot Range, a trajectory that danced round General Howard's pursuing troops for 4 months. The troops, subjected to frequent ambushes, seldom knew quite where they were. Exhausted after trekking 1,500 miles, the band was finally forced to camp within a few miles of the Canadian border. At this point, they were intercepted by another column of soldiers based nearer the border. It was able to move on the Nez Perce because their position had been telegraphed by the pursuing troops to the south. So what then has this to do with drawing? Well, it connects with my interpretation of the exhibition's linkage of drawing, dance, and performance as a discourse on how we map or are mapped in social space-time. Indeed, Winters and Cunningham's performance Loose Time is described as mapping territory by the bodies of the dancers. But the Nez Perce story highlights more than this. A tension between our embodied relations to the world and disembodied technologies. And I would suggest that what is at stake here are truth and ethics as they are realized on the intersubjective plane. Aside from being drawings, maps were amongst the first disembodied technologies. Visualizing the world from some totalizing God's eye view is a tool for control of territory, trade, and military advantage. So I shall introduce two medieval maps. Sorry, I'm a bit veering off the modern here. This is Tabula Rugia. It charts the towns and natural topography of the then-known world, that is to say, no Americas and no Australia. 100 years later, we have the Psalter map from Westminster. Jerusalem is the spiritual center. Below Christ at the top, which is actually the east, are Adam and Eve, and then moving down, the Old Testament world, leading to the classical and New Testament world, and at the bottom, which is the west, we have Britain with the French territories claimed by the English King Henry III. To the right, which is to say the south, are the monstrous races on the outer edge of the civilized world, a rather all too familiar representation, I might add. The difference between these maps is that the first is spatial and commercial, albeit with military potential. It visualizes the trade route known as the Silk Road and could not have been drawn without the practical knowledge of hundreds of travelers. The second is both spatial and temporal, but it maps the theological and ideological world driven by belief. The Nez Perce story also maps two different structures, territorial and telegraphic. The Nez Perce structure is bound to the spatio-temporal reality of the experiential body and cultural memory. The people belonged with the landscape, and so, unlike the cavalry, were masters of movement through it. It also maps a field of digressions and inventions. Here the human trace is respectful, the soft tread of the moccasin against the imprint of the military boot. This distinction is implied in Stephen Yazzie's drawing and driving art cart trip across Monument Valley. It recalls an ecosystemic relation to world, where body, language, culture, and landscape are mutually constituted. Likewise, the complex knowledge system mapped by Kungwari's dreaming paintings. As I understand it, in the Aboriginal worldview, every event leaves a trace, suggesting one should be mindful of the traces one leaves behind. Turning to the US military in the Nez Perce story, one can picture them stumbling around the woods with deepening frustration. But they possessed a technology that introduces a different relation of space-time to body and territory. What is important to telegraphy and now telematics is the economic efficacy of information and its transmission between sender and receiver, point to point, or better, target. For instance, the GPS can locate each of us instantly from the ultimate panoptical God's eye view. Telematics dispenses with experience, memory, and creative choice, and to this extent renders information impersonal and its truth value unverifiable. And it sacrifices ethics. If there is no actual person to respond to, then there is no need for the ethical answerability that any encounter demands. Depersonalized technocratic logic leads to murder by remote control. Armed aerial drones and so-called spot-and-shoot PlayStation consoles, whose invisible operators can target unsuspecting victims hundreds of miles away. If this is an extreme example of telematics used by power to produce and control social space, a counterpoint is its use by social networking sites to mobilize and assemble dissenting bodies in real time and space. And obviously, recent examples would be in the UK, the student demonstrations, and last week, what was going on in Tunisia. My first countermap is a detournement or interference in the map as a tool in systems of location and control. It is by Grupo de Arte Callejero, based in Buenos Aires. Aquí Viven Genocidos was a publicly distributed map and video of the home addresses of officials responsible for torture and disappearance under Argentina's military dictatorship, but who had never been prosecuted for these crimes. My second countermap is Alice's The Loop, an aerial paseo of 29 days around the Pacific Rim from Tijuana to San Diego to avoid crossing the US-Mexican border. As is typical of Alice, the faux innocent loop and oceanic horizon points to a limit, the US border fence, to restrict movement of economic migrants and, no doubt, drug traffickers. And here it is. Oh, sorry. And here it is between Yuma and Calexico. It's not quite the running fence that Christo had in mind. Any border, of course, describes a line that both separates and unites two sides in an inexorable relation. Maps reveal little of the embodied reality on the ground. Hence, my third countermap is Solid Sea, the Roadmap by Multiplicity, a collective of artists and architects which focuses on the Mediterranean basin. To paraphrase Paul Klee, Multiplicity took a line for a drive. It consisted of two journeys by taxi between two latitudes in the West Bank. In one journey, a Multiplicity member with EU ID was accompanied by a person with Israeli ID, the other by a person with Palestinian ID. The bold line is on the Israeli ID side of the map. The former journey took a hassle-free 1 hour. The latter took more than 5 hours due to detours around military roadblocks and Israeli-only roads, taxi changes, and delays at ID checkpoints. Multiplicity maps the territory through the politicized bodies of the travelers, revealing more about the relation between everyday life and control of urban space than any abstract map. My final countermap is Mademoiselle de Scudery's imaginary Carte du Pays de Tendre. It dates from 1654. which plots an emotional geography and was designed to instruct on the delights and pitfalls of love relationships. The traveller, starting from Nouvelle Amitié, can plunge incautiously downriver to La Mer Dangereuse, or meander overland through villages named sincerity, respect, obedience, and so on. These responsive but unpredictable intersubjective qualities are precisely what the logic of telematics attempts to bypass. In sum, if telegraphy and telematics seek to eliminate the human in favor of the speed of transmission between points of origin and reception, drawing and its extensions map the interval between embodied relations open to invention, diversion, transgression, and chance encounters. So does drawing have a social role? Perhaps to imagine how we might map ourselves and others more equitably and ethically. In any case, it is for each generation to decide what it is for them. Thank you.
The line in the phenomenology of living. First, I would like to thank Catherine de Zegge, Cornelia Butler, and the Museum of Modern Art for this invitation. My speech is subjective, the speech of an artist who loves to draw and has been using drawing in different ways for 50 years of artistic output. Line has been a constant element in my work for developing various work such as Super 8 film, performance, photographs, videos, sculptor, and drawings. Please allow me to quickly show you some of this work, as I am hope they may give greater meaning to the words that will follow. They are general images from three exhibitions where the presence of line is evident. The retrospective Territory of Immanence at Miami Art Center in 2006, the installation Continuous presented at Camden Art Center in London, and the retrospective held at Antoni Tàpies Foundation in Barcelona in 2010. Well, I take as a standard point the drawing line because drawing has always been and still is my first tool to be using, serving as a bridge that leads my mind from the immaterial to the tangible. It makes me say, I exist because I draw. For those who draw their desires alongside their experience of living. We know that the line and its point are the fundamental part of drawing. Thus, when we speak of drawing, we are speaking of line, the great interpreter. To our gaze, the line and its points are visible in world thing as a part of nature. When it is invisible, it manifests through our energy and vibrates, vital impulse in our body. Etymologically speaking, we know that the verb designare in Portuguese comes from Latin designare, to designate, to mark, point to a great number of definitions, such as to create, to take note, to observe, to invent, to construct, to propose, to signal, to project, to cogitate. I also learned that English to draw is used extensively for a great number of concepts, including to take out, to extract, to attract. Thus, we find ourselves in a territory of multiple meanings that get articulated in the vast field of the phenomenology, giving greater amplitude to consciousness. That is, a better understanding of the self, of our surrounding, of the reality of the world. In the recess of this consciousness, through an inquisitive vision, arise the poetic act that gives meaning to what is intuitive and seen. In the course of this originary gaze, based on my own experience as an artist, I restate that drawing is a product of the agency of the mind with the basic function and action of human living. This ancestral function and action make drawing and the possibility of language construction into one single unit, the substratum of our genetic code. Constructing language, materializing feeling, we give and receive in a symbiotic interchange relation. In this sense, perception, the originary activity of consciousness, trigger and manifest signification together with the object. The surrealist used to say that drawing is the echo of our impulses and dream. As far as I am concerned, it is so, but drawing is also a construction of materiality, because the materialized line can occupy the multiple dimension of real space. Contemporary artists are those who have gone to utmost extreme to assemble discourses, work, that go beyond the traditional support of art of drawing with line. They put the line in a broader view on the horizon living as a phenomenal resource for creation. In this sense, while I am writing this text, typing words letter by letter, is a succession of points that form a sequence line within the space of the computer, I perceive that many poetic acts in contemporary art depend on intention, on the metaphor and symbols that artists construct within the realm of daily action. At the same time, a singular image from my childhood comes to mind. My first grade teacher talking about the symbolism of the line, while she drew three lines on the blackboard, one vertical, one horizontal, and one diagonal. Then she solemnly said, "The vertical line symbolizes life, the horizontal one symbolizes death, while the diagonal line indicates movement." Although I was only a child, her explanation sounded too strict to me. I remember raising my hand and asking, "What if you mix the three lines repeatedly many times?" She looked at me sternly, as I had uttered a heresy and did not answer. Today, metaphor of contemporary art provide an answer, superposing a great quantity of those three lines, we shape an indecipherable chaos in which nevertheless we find the inherent possibilities of order, the life generating phenomena. The exhibition online drawing through the 20th century, like a single collective mind of creation, with the world it included, arranged in a free and unconventional fashion, is in line with my affection for line and drawing, assure me of the importance and the contribution of the vital function of living to creation. It revives me the word of Brazilian art critic Mario Pedrosa, who said that art is, above all, the experimental exercise of freedom. I would like to end by reading a small poem about drawing that I wrote back in 2001, which was published by the Drawing Center in New York in January 2002. Poetry always speaks in a more synthetic, clear, and acute way. Like a river, the thread, a flowing line runs after the spool rolling over the tile of the floor. Chessboard, cold terracotta floor. 1 + 2, 3 pawns, a line. Of pawn and line, Kandinsky tells us beautifully, just recalling his thought. His thought suffices. As the indecided hand poses the pen on the notebook, The point is the bridge between word and silence. There it is, affirming its nakedness in the solitary appearance of living dead. Beseeching movement. Unsensely, the hand complies. By multiplying, it lives. The line that renders it human is born. The drawing gets done. The sound. The writing. Its shyness in the immensity of the firmament. Is the sound that illuminated us. And now go is the thread, making its way through the door, reaching the kitchen, the line, free and attaching to its pool.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here listening to each of you, and thank you for the invitation, Catherine and Connie and MoMA. I had written about my work, but I think I'll just speak about drawing as I work with it, and how drawing, everything in my work is dependent on drawing. Years ago when I was first began really trying to understand my work, I took one mark, and you know, the possibility of what a mark could be on a piece of paper was still is whenever I'm starting something new, this is what I do is I have a piece of paper and either a pencil or a pen and or a brush with ink, and I make this mark. And immediately the process I go through is what is that mark to me? What does that mark mean? And at the beginning, earlier in my work, in order to understand what my intention with wanting to be an artist and drawing, I started to really think of these marks as behaving, as having some sense of identity, some sense of agency by themselves. So one mark by itself, really, it was hard to understand what that intention was. But that mark repeated in a group of marks, almost like writing, in one way, one mark being repeated along a line, behaved one way, and I thought of it and read it in a particular way. Oh, I meant to start the slide. I should have let you know, Tal. Please, if you could start the images. And as that mark, if a mark was a circle with a line. If that mark repeated in a particular way, it would create a system by itself. It could create a system. It could create a whole that mark would be defined by that context, but also defined that context. And to me, that became something that was interesting because it somehow mimicked how I thought of myself or thought of how my intention, not just in making, but in being. And so the mark became the point of really like the basis of my work. And as I continued to draw and make paintings, it was usually in order to support these marks, to give context to these marks, the space, the ground that the mark is drawn on, the architectural language or the line became then a space for the actual mark. That would suggest some type of social space, some type of historical space. So the line and the mark, the marks could create line, but marks by themselves had very different intention, and the process of making them was very different than taking a ruler and actually drafting space or creating, using linear space to suggest map type of space or these other kind of more Cartesian abstract notions of space. So there became these two different types of ways of working. The intuitive, gestural mark making, where there was early on very small kind of glyph-like marks that evolved into more notational type of quick gestural mark making, where the idea could come quickly, where the evolution of the image just would grow from within the marks themselves and from me making them, and then the process in the studio of trying to make sense of those marks and of what happened with those marks and what happened in that space? How do these marks affect space, this particular type of space, this collapse of different types of
drawn space, how do they interact, and what does that image then become? And this is basically what I keep going back to and keep questioning in the work. The type of space changes, whether it's the type of historical space, the ruin, the stadium, the military bunker, that those types of space can inform the way the painting will look. They inform the structure of the painting. The mark then shifts that and challenges that space in a different layer. And then there's another type of line or another type of mark that is actually, in a sense, trying to make sense of the way that those marks affected that space or changed that space or became part of that space or were absorbed into that space. And those lines then become somewhat referential to you as a viewer, to you as a maker in front of the image, trying to then make sense. Then your body becomes part of the painting in a way as well, and of the image, and your reference to this minute mark or to a larger gesture or to the larger kind of more analytic line. These layers, one on top of the other, became really kind of more important. And as I continue to work with the drawing, every time I finish a group of paintings, I go back to working on paper, and the process is drawing and erasing and drawing and erasing until a form starts to make sense and the new idea reveals itself, almost like an archaeological process in actually trying to understand the kind of formation of the language, and again myself in that process. And so, to me, what I'm interested in finally within that is not just the marks and the lines, but this space that exists, that this form that develops between the two, this place that is between the erasure, between the mark, and between the line, that between the the collapse of them, and the kind of very condensed space. Within that space, there's a potential, and there's a form that emerges, and it's that form of an unknown space. I think of it almost like a space of agency, a space of possibility, and it's that I look for in working that shifts me when the painting becomes an image that I am not expecting from that information, not expecting from those marks, that becomes what I'm, I guess, most interested in becomes the central focus of what I try, why I paint every day, or why I go back to the studio to find that moment. And in that moment, that gives me some idea, some new understanding of this type of information, all the information that goes into the work. So for me, drawing is central to the work. It's a process that informs the way that I make and questioning, but it's also the actual work becomes itself through drawing and line and mark and the space that's in between that.
I think now, if all the speakers can come up for a conversation and some questions for the audience, and then we'll follow that by about a 20-minute break.
Well, thank you so much, all four of you, for very wonderful presentations. I think we first have a little bit of a discussion among us, and then we open to the floor. The one thing I noticed in all of the presentations was, in fact, what Jean called the social role of drawing. And, in a way, Luis, you touched on it, although we spoke of a tool of information, a tool of connection also, then Jean also about the intersubjective and the embodied relations, what makes us human, making sense of the world around us, Anna Maria, and Julie just also with the notion of these lines and marks being, in a way, characters who define the context, but which are also defined by the context, and that's where she, in fact, speaks about herself. And some of you were almost using the same words about the space between the lines, the space of potential, and of that being a focus of drawing. So in a way, Jean, of course, you took it further to a more controlling aspect of our society. And would you want to say something more about that? About how line, you know, this this move from the from the embodied to the disembodied?
I don't want to say that so much as to...
I always portray it wrong.
No, I want to raise another point that I'm desperately trying to get to, because I'm in a crisis about art at the moment. I don't know what it is anymore, and I don't know what it does anymore, and that's after 30 years of being involved in it and got to a crisis. But I want... but I want to just mention something that Louise said some years ago, and tell me if I'm misquoting you here.
I remember, yes.
But what he said was incredibly important to me. He said, if I make a minimal mark on a piece of paper...
A dot.
That's a minimal mark. A dot, then. If I make a dot on a piece of paper, I have changed the order of the cosmos. And a bit more. But the implications of that were incredibly large for me. It immediately implied that whatever act one performs, you have a responsibility to it in terms of world. And I've never forgot that. It was one of the most crucial things that anyone ever said, I think.
I have to be careful.
So, I mean, partly that was the point for me of my presentation. I am perplexed at what we can do with the disembodied technologies that retain any kind of humanness. So it's the ethics of that statement of Louise's that I try to hang on to as being, you know, the important thing around any act, in fact, drawing or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not so much different. Louise, you want to add something?
Well, not much, but the thing was that it was more about the power and the empowerment of our actions than about the skills used to do them. So what I was actually, this was 40 years ago. I mean, you heard it later, but the statement is 40 years old. And the idea was that whatever I do, whoever takes inventory of the universe will have to account for that change. And the power involved in making that dot is equivalent to a nuclear bomb, or even more, ultimately. And so it's not about abusing that power, since which I can't, but about sharing that power, since anybody can make a dot. Mm. And so there's a pedagogical implication. Basically, it's a guideline of the way I teach, when I used to teach.
But so in a way, a dot, a line is a response to the world, which is each other, because you make, you know, you respond.
Not necessarily a response, it's an action.
Yes, but in this way, you exist. It's a way of showing yourself that you exist. And it's, but at the same way, it's also connecting you to a world. So I always read it as a response, which is the ability to respond. And I think that's where, you know, this responsibility is where, of course, there's a lot to do in contemporary society. The answerability.
Answerability. Responsibility is a problematic word in English because it immediately sort of evokes some kind of like moral thing. That's not what I'm interested in.
That's not what I'm interested
in. No, it is being answering to, mm-hmm. being responsive to, that more in that meaning than any sort of like moral mm-hmm. obligation. Although I think there is an ethics, of course, in it.
Response sounds a little bit too passive for me. Mm-hmm. So I think you can say, you don't have to wait that somebody tells you something to answer. But accountability is a crucial word. Mm. Mm-hmm. So you say mm-hmm. and are accountable for what you say.
Mm. So, but it's still a means of empowerment, no? That's how you see it.
Anybody can say, but anybody should be accountable for what they say.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that with the new disembodied technologies that is disappearing?
It depends who uses it. I think one of the advantages of that kind of networking is that geography, territorial geography, disappears and the communities are based on infography and not geography. Mm. And that is a way of empowering people. So you're not in a community where you're locked in into a specific physical space. Mm-hmm. But you're locked in into specific interests and causes. And in that sense, I think it's a step forward, as long as it remains a free area.
Mm-hmm. But Gerardo Mosquera, the Cuban critic, in one of his texts, he says it's very easy for us in the West to like make this assumption that everyone is now connected in this like global network. But he says that forgets that out there, there are vast zones of silence, as he calls them, of people that aren't connected. Mm-hmm. And so I think we sometimes forget in the Western world other realities.
I don't know if that's totally true anymore. There are more cell phones in Africa than anywhere other place of the world. And the issue of computing is rapidly growing. So it may be in this moment a true statement, but I don't think it's a long-range statement.
Well, it's true that apparently Tunisia has one of the best education systems, which then...
Well, I mean, that was very interesting what was happening in Tunisia last week mm-hmm. by the web. But at the same time, everyone might... I don't have an iPhone, but everyone else might have an iPhone in the world. But then the capacity of those who control those technologies to shut them down, mm-hmm. or other people to hack and knock them out, you know, is also ever-present. So I'm not sure it's a good idea to rely too much on disembodied technologies.
Right. Well, Julie, what is... I mean...
I should shut up.
So if you're in a crisis?
No. I'm in a crisis.
Julie, well, you see your characters as, you know, agents. So that's always something that fascinated me.
I mean, it goes back to what you were saying about the dot and the possibility and just insistence on self. And I think that to me, especially in this context, the power of the feeling you have some sense of agency, you have some possibility within yourself, especially as things move more rapidly and in this sphere where that can feel really meaningless, or seems to be meaningless. That's for me. That's the one of the empowering parts of making is that it's this insistence on self. It's this insistence on the individual self,
which you find in drawing.
Yeah, in making, in drawing for me, but yeah.
Anna Maria.
Oh. You know, I'm totally lost because I'm sorry, I'm ashamed, but my English can...
It's very good.
No, I English. Cannot follow. Very, very clear, each one, you know. I just ask to Luis, what is that? It's a point.
Point.
Okay.
Well, then say it in Spanish, and Luis will translate it.
Well, but what do you want?
the power of drawing. The
poder del dibujo.
Ah, but I think I told that.
Yes.
In my poetry, I says I think every what I'm feeling, you know, I don't know if I was not clear, and also I thought about the point who was. Ask movement because it's live and dead, because when it's there, it's dead. This way I can. I'm sorry, really sorry, and thank you, Katia and Cornelia, but you know, really, it's not enough for to discuss.
But you speak about the drawing as the exercise of freedom.
Yes, and also I told... I exist because I draw. Mm-hmm. Because when you draw, you and also when I find the motivation for this test, and I think about the and I went to see what because for me drawing is the first contact for with the world, with yourself. And this way, when you exist, because you begin to recognize yourself and the other. Mm-hmm. And the drawing is doing this this point. And also, I think it's the basic of in visual art for everything, you know? For me, it's a very preconceptuous feeling, but artists who don't know to draw is not art, artist. Because for me, you need to draw because it's the first movement, is the first one. And when I says in my test, it's in the base of genetic code, mm-hmm. because I believe, and it's not me, also many linguistic and from scientists, they tell. Man, woman bring inside the possibility of the language. It's genetic. In this way, for me, if the drawing is very very fine because semantically, if the humanity give this for drawing, this intention, this primary action and to take, to abstract, to indicate, to mark, because really is the human action in the world. In this way, the drawing is the basic of everything. I'm sorry, Lil. I'm sorry. This
primary. No, it's very good. It's very good.
And this way, I think it really is all everything the possibility of the language also. Near to the words, no, to the sound, and the performatic, they are inside it because the line is exist. This beautiful video you are put there from Louis
Louis Fuller
is everything. It's speaking much better than me about the vital impulse in the body, you know. Why I love draw.
But Anna Maria said something that's quite important to me. She said, response of self and other. It would be self as other. There is always an other. So when you're talking about drawing, it's not just some self-indulgent, self-absorbing act, but it is a recognition, yes. As you say, of the other. Mm-hmm. Even the other in yourself. Yes.
And there is a social function.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why so the map you show was so sad for me, because, you know, there also how this map is that they are historic, mm-hmm. historicals.
Mm-hmm.
Historical. Mm.
So we came full circle. the role of drawing, is it social or not? And I think we've been responding to that. I don't know how we're doing with the time. Is this? It's 2:15. We should probably open to the floor. Yes.
Luis, yeah, and Ana Maria, I'm interested in the relationship between printmaking and drawing for you, because both of you have a background in printmaking. O relacionamento entre gravura y diseño para vocês.
La relación entre grabado y dibujo para ti.
You know, the technique in art is very important because it's the tool who help you to put out what you want to express, but I don't think they are really important. You have to know also, because only you can transgress. You can transgress only if you know, otherwise you can do that. But drawing and gravura and
printmaking,
they are graphic. They have all the what Kandinsky tell us, the pond and line, the medial tone, everything, the language of drawing. I don't never did a many difference between the gravura,
printmaking,
and drawing. You know, because also I was thinking about more. I was more worried about how can show what I have inside, my feeling. You know, and many times I mixed the two. Technique. I think the technique is your service for help you, not for never technique did the artist.
Hi, all the talks were really wonderful. And I have a question for Luis, but maybe everyone, if they're interested, could respond to it. When you began by saying that it seemed important to distinguish between drawing as information processing versus a craft. And I'm a student of literature, and I was especially interested by what you said about drawing possibly working the same way as literacy works. And I wonder if you could say anything else about that, or the rest of you who have written about drawing or about your own artistic practices, if you could say anything else about the relationship between drawing and literacy.
I don't know if I can answer it the way you want, but one thing, first of all, I don't believe in skills. I mean, a little bit what Ana Maria said. I believe they are at the service of something else, and that something else is to, on one hand, solve a problem the best way you can, and therefore you choose the way you best solve it. And for that, then you invent or appropriate a skill. You invent it if there's no appropriate skill there, or you reinvent the skill if it is there. And unless you show the viewer in the second process, which is you want to communicate, and you show the viewer that the skill you're using has been invented only for the thing you are conveying, you're not doing a good piece. So the skill has to have an inevitable function, one that cannot be substituted any other way. So writing seems to be a pretty good tool in that sense when you want to send a message, or a subversive message, or a love declaration under the table. You send a little paper with your scribbles in a way that the other person understands it. And there's no other way to solve that process, that problem in that given moment. And So I don't see much difference between drawing and literacy. I certainly don't see any difference between handwriting and drawing. I think it's the same. From that point of view, anybody who is able to sign a piece of paper a little bit beyond of a cross, let's say, or even including the cross, is able to draw. That doesn't mean that it will be collectible for a museum, but it's a drawing. And if it serves the purpose of solving the problem correctly in the best way possible, it's fine. And that applies to whatever you do with words as well. I don't know if I did. But.
More questions?
Hello. Can you hear me? This is a question about doing, and I'd like to address it to Julie in particular. She mentioned her intuitive approach towards making the first marks. And then she said that there was a somewhat more critical eye, if I'm remembering what you said correctly, in the follow-up marks that you make. In other words, I see your work, and I wouldn't mind if you'd address that whole idea of layering, that there are works, there are marks on top of marks on top of marks, and I wonder if these marks are having some kind of conversation with one another, and that you are determining the kind of marks that you make by what came before.
I think that there's several questions in that. I don't think of the narrative doesn't unfold that clearly like that. It's much more abstract for me. The experience of making, the experience of drawing, is one, and that organic, intuitive experience is one particular type of practice. Then there's another process that tries to take that process apart and make sense of that process. Fundamentally, you can't make sense of it, and that's what I'm trying to find, is that place that doesn't make sense within there. That place in between, trying to make sense of something that was basically like an experience, doesn't have to happen on the paper. It can be being. It can be a social experience, and then trying to understand that. It's that place within that an image comes that gives me some kind of insight on. It becomes an image I don't expect. And that's to me what I'm interested in. It's like the space underneath. What happens in the drawing? Early on when I first was working the marks, some were more aggressive in their nature, the marks, and some. And this was a way for me to make sense of my language, of my drawing. But also what I realized after years of doing this, I keep drawing and then erasing and drawing to try and find another form, another idea within there. For me, it's an insistence again on maybe being, and it's just fundamental to working. It's not just by myself. It's me trying to make sense of a situation as well, a social situation, a political situation, and my place within that. And in order to do that, this is my technique. I can compare it to reading, and then. Trying to make sense of reading poetry reading fiction and reading the news and trying to make sense of what is happening, what your place is within that. It's a way for me to understand and digest information.
Hi, everyone has been talking about this process of drawing, and I interpret it basically your impulse in living or thinking. But I'm also curious to hear about the end result, the meaning that is there for us to see at the end. No one's addressed that. It's as if you've arrived at this place almost without direct intention, but Julie's work, for me, has this incredible meaning, and I'm wondering about your intention there at the end.
Luis, you want to answer?
Me?
Yeah.
The problem is that it's not clear what you understand under meaning. You mean a content that can be explained, or do you mean an evocation that produces that is produced in your person. But in my case, I don't leave it open in a 360 degree. I leave it open in a narrow angle, and that basically I manipulate the viewer, to put it bluntly, and I manipulate it in a very precise way. I open an angle within which the viewer believes that he or she is totally free and is reaching their own conclusions, and I don't want them to overstep the limits of that angle. It doesn't mean that I'm always successful, but the point is I plant a seed, and I want a specific plant to grow in you. And so I set up conditions. I don't set up an object. I don't care about the object. The object is a tool or a corridor or a window through which I communicate with you and hope that you don't say, oh, what a nice window, but rather understand that something is coming through. So in that sense, there is a meaning, but it's a meaning of not a precise meaning. If I could explain that meaning, I wouldn't do the piece. It's a more intangible angle of evocations within which I'm satisfied if it changes your life forever.
Like Jesus. Ana María, so, well,
okay,
I can say,
well, basically confirming.
I don't know. I think it will be very pretentious for an artist to control all the meanings for the spectador, for the public. This is impossible. You have some time in mind, many things, and you first one, the artist is very, very, very egoist, if you want
selfish.
To think. No? We think first one, I think so. I don't know if possible I'm wrong. You think to satisfy yourself. But anyway, the public is this, I think so, is also human. And have the same feeling than the artist. And possibly sometime the artist, if he communicates very, very well what he wanted, touch the other. But also, I always hope the public can be free and make his their metaphor. I hope my work will be
a kick
for the public, you know. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think like with my work, there's a lot of information, but there's not a the art doesn't happen in reading it. The experience happens in with time you spent in realizing the image, what the image. There's a lot of information that's there that could look like one particular type of image. But when you spend time with a paint, really spend time with a painting, then the image becomes realization in that experience is what is that place I'm talking about, that potential. I mean. For me, it's that experience, and that's not something that's necessarily determined by the artist or but it's not like something that's imposing itself on a person.
Well, this issue of meaning is very interesting. I mean, I'm not quite sure what it means, but it reminds me that the philosopher Jean-Luc Nancy said in one of his books, there is no meaning unless meaning is shared, which kind of like makes sense. But it's because he's talking about, like we don't exist in the world as I, we exist in the world as us. And,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's
as far as I understand it.
Do we have time for more questions? Okay.
I have a question for Julie. It was really an interesting presentation. I so appreciated your the way you described your process and made it almost palpable. And you spoke very much about how you begin, how you make that first mark and where that takes you. And I wonder if this might relate a little bit to the last question, which is, how do you know when to stop?
That's difficult. I mean, it's when this other form has somewhat, when this other image comes out of the picture. I mean, if you take a stadium and you're looking at a stadium, you have an understanding of that space. You understand it, you experience it, you know what it feels like to be a part of it. It has a very specific social kind of intention. And when you can make a picture of that that becomes something else, that the experience of that even shifts your your understanding of how that space is meant to work or does work. It's when that change, when something else comes out of that space and the drawing, that for me, that's when it usually, when I stop the picture. When this other form has emerged in a way, this other.
Ana Maria, you want to add something?
Yeah. No, it's funny. No, I'm sorry.
It's funny? Well, yeah, why not?
I remember Calder in his one film, somebody asked, when you think your work is ready? And he answered, when is our lunch?
Okay, well,
when is our lunch?
Yeah.
So let's end here.